For Nolan's new movie, Oppenheimer, has been a box office success, raking in more than $400 million in its first 10 days. For context, that's more than his movie Batman Begins made in its entire theater run. The film follows the story of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the scientist who directed the Los Alamos Laboratory for the Manhattan Project during World War II, who later became known as the father of the atomic bomb.
Well, we had a moment where it looked like the chain reaction from an atomic device might never stop.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want for theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
As General Leslie Groves, played by Matt Damon, talking to J. Robert Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy, shortly before the first testing of the atomic bomb in southern New Mexico in July of 1945. The film has generated renewed interest in the history of nuclear weapons and the moral questions surrounding their creation and use as the world approaches the 78th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 9th, 1945. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you gone to see the new Oppenheimer movie? What did you think? Do you have questions for our guest about what the film gets right or wrong about the Manhattan Project and how the atomic bomb was created? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alex Wellerstein is a historian of science and nuclear technology. He's a professor at the Stevens Institute of Technology and author of the book Restricted Data, The History of Nuclear Secrecy in the United States. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm really pleased to be here. Thank you.
You've seen the movie a couple times now, I understand. First of all, when it comes to using this movie as a conversation starter, a teachable moment, what do you think the movie gets right that people could pursue in more depth?
There's a lot that it gets right. I mean, there's a lot of attention to detail. I will say the thing that I am most impressed by, as somebody who spent a lot of time thinking about Oppenheimer, they get an aspect of Oppenheimer's personality right that's very easy to get wrong. He is not some sort of everyman. He is also not some kind of inspirational science figure. He's a very complex, somewhat troubled, somewhat insecure guy from the beginning. And I'm really appreciative of them getting that right, because I think the temptation is to turn him into some kind of hero or martyr, and they do something more complicated with him, and I really like that.
Give us a quick introduction for people not familiar with Oppenheimer. Who was he as a person at this pivotal moment in the history of our species, really?
Oppenheimer is a person who sort of at his core is trying to be this very, he wants you to be impressed by him. That's clear from very early on. He wants to belong. He wants to be you to be impressed by him, but he also simultaneously sort of wants to go his own way. And these internal conflicts, this is kind of what guide him through a lot of his life. And it's one of the ways in which this guy who is really not your stereotypical military scientist ends up running this weapons project and building this weapon, which he himself is sort of building it in part because he wants to ban them from the world. And like, these are the paradoxes of this guy, and also why when you hold him up to a microscope, as they do in the 50s, because he has questions about his whether he deserves a security clearance, he doesn't fit the mold in a really stereotypical way, and, you know, can't really hack it in a sort of later Cold War environment.
One critique you've brought up elsewhere, I grew up with this argument or this understanding of the use of the first nuclear weapons dropped in wartime, and only nuclear weapons so far dropped in wartime, that there was this very careful strategic consideration at the highest levels of American government that said, yes, we're going to use this weapon. Yeah, maybe it's a horrible weapon, but it's going to prevent the United States from having to invade mainland Japan to end World War II. We're making this calculation and it's worth it. And you say the recent scholarship doesn't really back up that understanding. Can you flesh that out for us?
There's been a lot of work over the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years where historians who are not quite in that old Cold War debate mode have sort of looked at this with fresh eyes. And what they find is that whole narrative, this what we might call the decision narrative, which sets it out as you had to sort of the idea is that this was very deeply considered and the long-term implications were deeply considered, and yet it was the best of all possible outcomes, and it was sad that we had to do it, but we had to do it. It doesn't match what the people in 1945 were actually thinking, who were in charge of this decision. It was a more chaotic sort of process. They didn't know the future. How could they? I mean, none of this by itself ought to be surprising. But the idea was, well, we'll just try everything. We have a bomb. Of course, we're going to use a bomb. They're not that concerned about Japanese civilians. They don't see it as some big trade-off. They think, oh, yeah, maybe it'll end the war early. Maybe the Soviet Union entering will end the war early. Maybe if we threaten them in the right way, they'll end the war early. We'll try everything because we don't really want to fight this war any further. It's not some sort of difficult moral dilemma. And the decision-making process is much more decentralized. There's people in the military making certain decisions. Some of the decisions that seem so fateful to us now, like dropping the second one when they do, that's done by people on the island of Tinian who are doing this because the weather forecasts. And none of this is to say that this means you can't support the use of the bombs or you should oppose them. But this rational version of it, this one that makes it sound like it's the product of a lot of strategic and logic, you know, political, philosophical, almost ethical thinking, that was invented after the fact because people were starting to criticize it in the 1940s. And so coming up with this sort of way of thinking about it, it's a very persuasive way. If you go down that logical path of the decision narrative, you think, well, they got it, probably had to use it. But that's why they invented it. It's not actually what people were thinking because they were human. They couldn't see the future. They weren't thinking about all of the things that you might later think about.
Talking to Alex Wellerstein, historian of nuclear technology, looking at the development and use of atomic weapons and the new movie Oppenheimer. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Alex, it does seem some people, including Oppenheimer, were thinking about the future. As you mentioned, Oppenheimer already thinking about banning these weapons he was developing. How big a split was there between people who viewed this new atomic bomb as, hey, a big weapon, but just another part of our arsenal, versus who saw it as a potentially world-changing technology that would change international relations and war maybe forever?
That's a super interesting question. It's interesting because at the time they're making this, there is a split. There are some people who see this as, this is going to change everything. This is going to remake the entire way the world has to operate. And then there are people who saw it as, hey, we have a very efficient way of burning cities. We already knew how to burn cities. We've been dropping napalm on cities, but normally it takes 500 planes. Now it only takes one plane. The interesting thing to me is that people have different stakes for wanting to subscribe to one of those approaches versus the other. So people who really think that this could be a vehicle for ending war in general, they really want to emphasize that this is a special weapon. That's the term they use. People whose relationship with the weapon is much more operational, like the people who are assembling the weapons on the island and actually dropping them out of planes, they often tend to see it as just another weapon. The military after the war, a lot of those high-ranking people emphasize that it's just another weapon because they didn't want conventional budgets cuts, right? They tried to sort of downplay it in a very deliberate way that later they didn't, because it turned out they didn't get their budgets cut. But this is, you know, how different is an atomic bomb? Is it different ethically or politically? This is an open subject for discussion. And it's an open subject for discussion even into the later 1940s. And to some degree, even today, there's versions of this debate that take place.
We're talking to science historian Alex Wellerstein from the Stevens Institute of Technology, looking at the making of the first atomic bomb, what the history can teach us today after the release of the new movie Oppenheimer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you learn about the atomic bomb in your high school or college history classes? Has your view of this history changed over the years? Have you seen the movie? Does it raise questions for you about the past, the present, or the future of nuclear weapons? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with nuclear nuclear historian Alex Wellerstein about the legacy of the atomic bomb after the successful release of the movie Oppenheimer, telling the story of the development of the first atomic weapons. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts, what questions, concerns do you have about nuclear weapons today? Have you seen the Oppenheimer movie? Do you have questions? If you're on hold right now, quick little blip in our phone lines, hang tight. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alex, I want to fast forward to the present day. Now, when I grew up, and it turns out a lot of people around the country did this, we used to argue about, you know, why our community was likely to be targeted by Soviet nuclear weapons. Oh, we're near to, you know, auto plants and things like that. It seems like the consciousness of nuclear weapons has gone down a lot today, but they're still out there. Why has this faded so much in our minds?
It's pretty interesting the degree that is when the Cold War ended, there's sort of a collective cultural sigh in the United States, and people are sort of relegate nuclear weapons to this thing that was a threat then, but now we're beyond it, and so on and so on. And of course, the weapons didn't go away. They did change in their amount deployed and some of the approaches to them. But there have been also arms races relating to these weapons that people haven't really noticed. Like, they've become much more accurate. And there's things like trying to ballistic missile defenses, which changed the calculus a bit. It's been interesting for me to see, because every few years, something happens that thrusts them right back into the limelight very briefly, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Russia and Ukraine. And we have this intense conversation about them. And then they just sort of disappear again as we move on to something else. And then some other crisis moment comes up and we have this intense conversation and we have this whole, why haven't we talked about this? And then we go back to the status quo of not thinking about them. And it's a really different from, especially the later Cold War, like the 80s, where they were a much more persistent cultural feature. I wonder if that's going to shift. I mean, we've had a lot of these events in the last couple of years, especially with Russia and Ukraine, that have made these, you know, what used to be thought of as just Cold War issues like NATO feel very, very relevant. And the future of them seem very, very vibrant, for better or worse.
One place very aware of the nuclear weapon history, Japan. We've seen some of the studios involved in the movie sharing kind of zany memes with the Barbie movie coming out at the same time, but with nuclear weapon imagery as we get closer to the anniversary, as I mentioned, of the dropping of the nuclear weapons on Japan. What do you make of this sort of online controversy where we're taking nuclear weapons pretty lightly, and it's a pretty serious topic?
It's a really complicated thing. The kitschy aspect of nuclear weapons is not new, or even the idea of the memes of them are not new, at least amongst Americans. The very first set of nuclear testing after World War II was called Operation Crossroads, and this was done at the Bikini Atoll, and this was a sort of sensation. And it's where we get the term for the bikini bathing suit is from this set of nuclear tests. And this is like a year after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to go from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these horrible, horrible, you know, tales of victims and things and the destruction, to haha, we've split the atom and the bikini is like a split atom because it's got two pieces. Like, this is I think this kind of paradox is at the core of American nuclear culture. It's the sort of thing that obviously the Japanese are not going to be pleased with. They have their own things, of course, that Americans find incomprehensible or even sometimes offensive, their own memes. I think that on the one hand, it's useful to remember, and I think the film tries to emphasize this in its way, that this is not a joke. These are really serious. We are not talking about even testing, which was itself not a joke and had consequences. On the other hand, it's not surprising that people today in particular, they want to engage with this. They're not engaging with it through the actual lived experience of people who suffered from these weapons. They're engaging with it at some distance. And I think that that creates some of that opportunity for treating it very lightly, treating it very humorously.
You mentioned even in the testing, people were harmed. And this is a live issue today. People in New Mexico upset that the movie didn't talk about the damage that the initial atomic weapon testing program caused to people, a very real damage caused to people in New Mexico. Can you talk about that a little?
So the movie, not to defend it, but it's trying to do things almost exclusively through Oppenheimer's perspective. And this was not something he thought very much about or saw. So understandably, it wouldn't be something he would have encountered. But yeah, there are the Trinity test is a big part of the movie and the part of the Oppenheimer and World War II Manhattan Project story. And it created a significant amount of radioactivity. This radioactivity, it was carried by its mushroom cloud as it went into the upper atmosphere and moved through the general atmosphere. It was detectable at very, very far distances. Despite the Trinity site being relatively isolated and chosen for that, it was not entirely without people nearby, especially given the vast distances that these clouds could go. And so there are a significant number of people who received radiation doses of different strengths as a result. And the Manhattan Project personnel, they had people in towns nearby with radiation detectors watching the meters go up after the test. And they were supposed to, you know, evacuate the town if it went above a certain level. And none of the towns, in their judgment, went above that level, so they didn't do this. Today, we would have a much lower level for what would be an acceptable amount of radiation. This, they knew about the hazards of intense amounts of radiation, but the amount, the hazards from sort of chronic and low amounts were really not that well understood then, did not even become really that understood through the 50s and 60s. Today, we have set the bar for what's an acceptable exposure much lower than they would have had then. But this was something that they were sort of working out and essentially deciding that other people were going, that the benefit of making and testing this weapon outweighed potential harms to people downwind of it. And that's, you know, quite a decision to make without any kind of oversight, democratic process, et cetera. So it's a pretty troubling legacy of the development of these weapons in general.
Let's bring on a caller. Paul is with us in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I heard your guest speak earlier of these kind of ideas of using of nuclear type of weapons, rather, as an open topic of conversation. And the question that came to my mind was where? Certainly not on NPR. It's certainly not on legacy media. We've got a group of people in Congress, a solidified legacy group on both the Republican and the Democratic side of the aisle, who are absolutely pro-war. In fact, there is no anti-war sentiment in the Congress. And yet we hear the same arguments. When you said teachable moment, Rob, I thought of myself thinking, well, why not use it for the present? We are currently using much of that same language against the Russians. And the dehumanization that we used in order to justify dropping this bomb and incinerating thousands of people in Japan.
Paul, thanks for the call. Alex, do you see there being open forums for discussion? Paul doesn't.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Paul's making a very important distinction between like who talks about these things. And certainly NPR is not going to be advocating the use of nuclear weapons. Thank goodness. And actually, your average people are not talking about this one way or the other most of the time. But there are people in the military, in the sort of defense complex, who do not see these weapons the same way that most average people do. They see them as potentially more usable, or they at least like to have options on the table. They see them in very like technical sense that often misses the broader context. And I think it's one of the dangers of there being this low public sort of salience, the fact that they're not part of our regular conversation. What that means is the people who get to dominate that conversation in policy tend to be the people who benefit the most from it. And this is not a conspiracy theory. This is like how lobbying works. This is how defense contractors work. And so one of my arguments for people should talk about this more and think about weapons more and get more politically involved with it more is because if you do not, the people who are going to be making those decisions are the people who benefit the most from either thinking about the weapons being more usable or having more of them. And I think that's a problem. I think that warps the policy conversation to a very small number of very interested people. So in a sense, I agree that this is kind of one of the issues that we're dealing with.
Let's take one more caller. Tom is with us in Spring Green. Tom, hi.
Hello, this is Tom. and I'm on my way home from Spring Green, and I remember in the days when there was a lot going on with nuclear that they had a film that I saw about Rocky Flats where they had people on a lathe that were cutting nuclear triggers, which were the same magnitude as that of what was dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A lot of these machinists were sick afterwards. And then actually my question is, could you talk about the relationship between Edward Teller and Oppenheimer?
Tom, I gotcha. Just a minute or so left, Alex. Quick thoughts on Edward Teller.
Let's do it all. Yeah, let's do it all. Well, Rocky Flats is fascinating. The production site that got shut down by the FBI and the EPA, if you don't know about it, that's incredible for a weapons production. Teller is so complicated. He gets turned into the villain. He is, in some ways, has terrible ideas. I have a little sympathy for Teller. I know that that's a heretical statement because he's not, I don't think he's like inherently an odious person. Whereas Louis Strauss, who plays a big part in the Oppenheimer movie, I thought they got across very well my impression that I got from reading his memoirs and memos. Louis Strauss feels just all the way rotten to the core. Teller had strong opinions and he expressed them poorly and he suffered for it. He's not the best guy, but he's also not like an evil person. Strauss, I don't know. The jury's out.
Thanks for that call. And Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This is fun.
That was Alex Wallerstein, nuclear historian and professor at the Stevens Institute of Technology. He joined us to talk about the new Oppenheimer movie and the history of the atomic bomb and ongoing debates over nuclear weapons to this day.